to voice their support for the Palestinian people and the resistance. They sent a message of solidarity for Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as Israel's unbridled and unfazed brutality continues unabated.
50 scholars, top scholars from 25 countries, they are gathered here, and hopefully they will reach to any kind of the solution, kind of support and solidarity for the people.
The Palestinians are sending a very strong message. Then look, you be answerable to this. You know, the accountability is not only in Israel who are the murderers, but accountability should also be there among the Muslims. Why are you not doing anything? So that's why Palestinians are giving that voice. They are struggling, they're saying they're going to fight to the end, and therefore they say if you want to help, it's your responsibility, it's not we appealing.
With the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza now in its fifth month and over 30,000 civilian fatalities, scholars in Beirut assert that the resistance in the region has no choice but to continue its armed struggle until the final victory.
The Muslim clerics in support of the resistance have stressed through their discussions and meetings here in Beirut that the Palestinian cause is a reason for unity and solidarity. They say the teachings of the Quran have drawn a roadmap for supporting the Palestinian people in their struggle to free a land considered holy to all Muslims. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A series of restrictions were imposed on the Yemeni economy following the U.S. redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group earlier this year. This blacklisting has had an impact on the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country, where millions of people are in dire need of aid.
Ansarullah as a political component has no external economic relations or companies in the private sector that have real weight in the national economy. The real goal of the resolution is to blackmail Ansarullah and distort their position in support of Gaza. The Yemeni economy has been in a state of siege for 9 years, and therefore the American measures putting pressure on the local economy we believe will not have much effect, especially since the Yemeni economy has withstood pressure over the past years and adapted to the measures imposed by the exiled Yemeni government in Riyadh. The Central Bank of Yemen will also work to impose procedures to secure the transfer of foreign exchange to and from Yemen.
Several international companies, including the money transfer company Western Union, have suspended their activities in Yemen, severely affecting the livelihoods of most Yemenis who rely on financial support from relatives abroad. Experts predict that such actions will lead to the creation of a black market for those benefiting from the suspension of money transfers.
The United States of America imposed collective punishment on the Yemeni people. Very important financial channels were stopped, such as Western Union, which is one of the most important money transfer networks in the world, and through it, Yemeni expatriates in American and European countries used to send money to their families in Yemen easily. We have 6 million expatriates outside the country and thousands of Yemeni families depend on them to provide a living. You can imagine what the situation will become after these financial transfers stop. The beneficiaries of this measure are black market workers who exploit these circumstances by deducing a percentage of their remittances and transfer them through illegal channels.
In an effort to deter Yemen's naval operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the U.S. Department of State blacklisted the Ansarullah movement as a specially designated global terrorist group. However, this designation has primarily affected the humanitarian situation, as members of the Ansarullah movement have no investments abroad.
Observers believe that Washington's recent measures are aimed at inciting the Yemeni people to take to the streets in opposition to the Ansarullah movement as a strategic move to undermine the group's popularity in the country. But that plot does not look like it will succeed, given the widespread support for Ansarullah in Yemen.
It was the second occasion on which Pakistani lawmakers elected Shehbaz Sharif as the new premier of the country. Shehbaz Sharif assumed office as Pakistan's prime minister for the first time in April 2022, following the dramatic ouster of Pakistan's jailed ex-prime minister Imran Khan from power through a parliamentary no-confidence vote. Sharif, the younger brother of Pakistan's three-time Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, secured 201 votes in the lower house of the parliament. He emerged victorious over his rival Omar Ayub Khan of the PTI party led by jailed ex-PM Khan, who managed to secure 92 votes. A candidate needs a simple majority of votes in the 336-member house to win the post.
From the deepest core of my heart, I thank those who with their votes and love elected me as the leader of this house. People have been given a split mandate in the general elections, and those having reservations about election results need to approach the appropriate forums. We have no personal egos, and the other side also needs to follow the suit for the sake of Pakistan.
The election of the new Pakistani premier was marred by nationwide protests by the supporters of imprisoned Imran Khan against alleged rigging in the recently held elections. Several party workers who were staging protest demonstrations against results manipulation in the recently held elections were arrested.
I'm here to request Election Commission of Pakistan, the Judiciary of Pakistan and Chief Secretary of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to take strict action against the ROs, the DROs, who not only violated the Election Act and election rules and oath of their offices, but also violated Constitution of Pakistan, in which preamble states that the people of Pakistan will decide the fate of their representatives through ballot.
The newly elected Premier Sharif, who is expected to take the oath of the office on Monday, has been congratulated by several neighboring countries, including China, Iran, and Turkey.
As Shehbaz Sharif assumes the role of Prime Minister for a second time, he is pitted against a multitude of challenges. These include fragile economic and political conditions. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean doctors rallied Sunday, threatening to go on strike following the government's decision to increase the quota for incoming medical students from about 3,000 to 5,000. Doctors say the measures will not necessarily alleviate the shortage of physicians in less desirable specialties and locations.
In essential medical care, the conditions are relatively poor and there are legal burdens such as frequent criminal lawsuits compared to non-essential medical care. It cannot be said with certainty that the increased number of doctors will flow into essential medical care and rural medical care.
Triggered by the government plan, 9,000 resident doctors in training out of 13,000 across the country walked out on February 20th. Patients have been scrambling for care with hospitals understaffed.
The government wants to win the general election by winning votes from the people, and that is why it is ultimately implementing populist policies without making a scientific or rational decision and without any preparation.
Polls suggest the South Korean public largely supports the government, and President Yoon Suk-yeol has seen his approval ratings increase since the standoff with doctors emerged. The government has filed criminal complaints against the leaders of the Korea Medical Association who organized this rally. Doctors who fail to comply with the back-to-work order face the suspension of their licenses, fines, and potential jail sentences. Both sides appear to be digging in. Medical schools don't have the capacity to accommodate so many new students, say some administrators. National Assembly elections are scheduled for April 10th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italian cities were the scene of rallies in solidarity with Gaza and in condemnation of Israel's inhuman attacks against Palestinian civilians. Rome, Florence, Pisa, Syracuse, Grosseto. For the umpteenth time since early October, tens of thousands of people across Italy took to the streets of their respective cities to express their anger at the Italian government for unconditionally supporting the Israeli regime and at the international community for its complicity in Gaza genocide.
Today, more than ever, international law is just an abstract set of norms which prevails over humanity. Millions of people have died since the Sykes-Picot Accord over 100 years ago, and we're still arguing over the fact that Palestine is a state or not.
We'll go down in history as those who silently supported the genocide period.
Italy has not condemned Israel for the killing of unarmed Palestinians collecting aid in Gaza in an attack that killed more than 100 people on Thursday. However, Rome has called on the Israeli regime to investigate the incident and bring the perpetrators behind the aid massacre to justice.
The Italian police crackdown on students during Palestine solidarity demonstrations in the past weeks has sparked outrage across Italy. Student collectives are at loggerheads with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and police over the rise in attacks against students.
The government and police repression has revealed the bare truth. Our country is a democracy only on paper. Ours are simply the democracies of double standards and deception. We have been attacked during our protest for peace in Ukraine, and we are attacked today. We perfectly know how democracies work in Western countries.
Thousands of artists, curators and critics have signed an open letter calling on the Venice Biennale, one of the world's largest contemporary visual art exhibitions, to exclude the Israeli National Pavilion from this year's art exhibition due to the brutal assaults against the civilians in Gaza. However, Italy's culture minister has firmly backed Israel's participation. Max Civili, Rome.
Across France, supporters of Palestine marched to denounce Israel's constant atrocities and war crimes during their latest invasion of Gaza. The world has been stunned by what's been dubbed the Flower Massacre, the death of over 100 Palestinians and the wounding of nearly 800 others after Israeli troops opened fire on civilians waiting for food.
We are here to ask for sanctions and to expose the hypocrisy of those who say they were shocked by the killing of people starving that were getting humanitarian aid, but at the same time don't do anything to stop the genocide.
Some 600,000 people in Gaza, or 25% of the population, are currently at risk of famine.
The French Foreign Ministry said the shootings were unjustifiable and backed a call for an independent investigation by the United Nations. French President Emmanuel Macron demanded truth, justice, respect for international law, and called for an immediate ceasefire.
In the Western world, which is and remains accomplice with the Israeli genocide, but a slight change in the tone of all those Western leaders, including Emmanuel Macron. Remember that a few months ago, Macron was proposing a military coalition to fight the Palestinian resistance in Gaza.
4 years ago, Macron forced through a bill which equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, despite the obvious differences between the two.
Il a deux visages.
Macron is two-faced. It is only since the International Criminal Court announced that they would investigate Israel that Macron began to say just a few words which were not in total support of Israel. He continues to give arms to Israel and is as complicit as the leaders in Tel Aviv.
Many marchers carried signs of deceased United States soldier Aaron Bushnell, who set himself on fire at the Israeli embassy in Washington after declaring that he will no longer be complicit in genocide. After the start of Israel's invasion of Gaza, France imposed a nationwide ban on pro-Palestinian demonstrations around the country. Activists were forced to endure mass arrests, a record number of fines, and the infamous brutality of France's police. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Once a boomtown of the Industrial Revolution, Rochdale in northwest England has been reliably labor for years. Until now. This was an election that saw allegations of fraud, desperate attempts like this one by the right-wing Reform Party.
Make sure you prevent George Galloway from being your MP for Rochdale.
And dominated by the massacre in Gaza.
From the river to the sea.
The result came hours after polls closed.
Hereby declare that George Galloway is duly
a sweeping victory for a veteran anti-war pro-Palestine campaigner who reminded everyone that the anger in Britain over the Gaza genocide is not confined to the Muslim community only.
Every Muslim is bitterly angry at Keir Starmer and his misnamed Labour Party. But you would be very foolish if you did not realize that millions of other citizens of our country are.
Rochdale is home to a 30,000-strong Muslim community.
George Galloway from Rochdale.
Apart from bread-and-butter issues such as the declining public services, unemployment, poverty, and crime that have racked the constituency for years, for the majority of the voters here, there was more to take into account.
This is a blessing to basically take our word straight to Parliament, and if one person just goes in there and asks for a ceasefire, asks for all these genocide to stop, it's more than any Labour candidate or Labour MP or anyone has done for many years.
He can bring change to us locally, but also nationally and internationally. So the thing is, the ongoing issue with Gaza is a big issue, and it's an international issue. But at the same time, it's not just a Muslim issue. It's about human rights.
The election was triggered by the death in January of opposition Labour Party MP Tony Lloyd. He was replaced by this man, Azhar Ali. On voting day, though, Labour's campaign center lay shuttered after the party abandoned Ali for making anti-Israel remarks.
By-elections don't always represent the wider national picture. They are protest votes with a local focus. Last time around, Labour won the seat here by 10,000 votes, but this time they lost. And perhaps that is a sign of what's to come, both for Labour and the Conservatives, with the general elections only months away. Saeed Puriza, Rochdale, Greater Manchester.
In the limelight.
Attorneys for Donald Trump and his co-defendants have made their final arguments to Judge Scott McAfee in a bid to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in Georgia racketeering case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Whether Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis should be removed from the Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants is now up to the Fulton County judge overseeing the matter, who said he would make a decision within the next 2 weeks. At a three-hour proceeding before Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, attorneys for each side presented legal arguments for and against disqualifying Fannie Willis from the case over her romantic relationship with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. It capped a series of extraordinary hearings following allegations from Michael Roman, a Republican operative charged along with Donald Trump, that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade had an improper romantic relationship and that the district attorney financially benefited from this. Donald Trump and seven others joined Roman's effort to disqualify Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade and her office from prosecuting the racketeering case against them and are seeking to have the charges against them dismissed. Prosecutors and defense attorneys gathered in Atlanta courtroom to present their closing arguments to Judge Scott McAfee. Nathan Wade attended the hearing while Fannie Willis sat at the prosecution's table to watch Adam Abate, who works in her office, give his presentation. The judge did not issue a decision from the bench, saying he has several legal issues to sort through and factual determinations to make before issuing a ruling. If this court allows this kind of behavior to go on and allows district attorneys across the state by its order to engage in these kinds of activities, the entire public confidence in the system will be shot and the integrity of the system will be undermined, said John Merchant, a defense attorney representing Michael Roman, who opened the arguments for the defendants. Adam Abate said there had been absolutely no evidence that the district attorney has benefited at all or would benefit in the future from the prosecution of the case. Michael Roman claimed that the relationship between Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis began before she hired him as special prosecutor in the case against Donald Trump in early November 2021. The two admitted in a court filing that they did have a personal relationship but said it started in 2022. Both Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade testified during evidentiary hearings last month and divulged personal details about their relationship, financial affairs and travels to places like Napa Valley, Belize and Aruba. During several hours on the witness stand, Fannie Willis forcefully defended herself from accusations she acted improperly and financially benefited from Nathan Wade's hiring. Defense attorneys claimed that Nathan Wade paid for hotel rooms, cruises and getaways, though both prosecutors said they split the costs associated with their travels. Fannie Willis said she reimbursed Nathan Wade in cash. To demonstrate that Fannie Willis typically used cash to cover expenses, on Tuesday prosecutors filed an affidavit from Stan Brody, who worked at a winery in Napa that she and Wade visited last year. Brody asserted that Fannie Willis paid $400 in cash. The district attorney had accused Ashley Merchant, Michael Roman's attorney, of spreading lies and salacious rumors. "You've been intrusive into people's personal lives," Fannie Willis said during her testimony on 16th of February. "You're confused. You think I'm on trial here. These people are on trial for trying to steal an election in 2020. I'm certainly not on trial, no matter how hard you try to put me on trial." CNN cable news network has also covered the same story. Donald Trump's attorneys on Friday, 1st of March, sought to delay one of his criminal trials until after the November election and disqualify the district attorney prosecuting another case against the former president in a split screen that underscored how all of Donald Trump's criminal cases can't help but overlap. In Florida, Trump's attorneys told Judge Eileen Cannon his Mar-a-Lago classified documents case should wait until after the 2024 presidential election. At roughly the same time in Georgia, attorneys for Donald Trump and his co-defendants made their final argument to Judge Scott McAfee in a bid to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in the Georgia racketeering case over her relationship with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. Neither judge made the decision on Friday, 1st of March, but both hearings could have a significant impact on when or whether Donald Trump will face trial in each of these two cases. Trump's legal calendar remains a jumble of pre-trial legal motions, with three of the four trials still in limbo. In addition to Florida and Georgia, Special Counsel Jack Smith's election subversion case in Washington remains on hold, with the Supreme Court set to hear arguments on Donald Trump's presidential immunity claims next month. The only case that appears set is Donald Trump's New York criminal trial. That will begin on 25th of March, which Trump's attorney said was a firm date in court on Friday, 1st of March. Meanwhile, a parade of defense attorneys in the Fulton County racketeering case argued that Fannie Willis should be disqualified, stating that she lied about her relationship with Nathan Wade and received benefits from him in the form of trips. Friday's hearing marked the final arguments in the case before Judge Scott McAfee rules on whether to disqualify Fannie Willis after several weeks of testimony that included Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis both taking the stand. The Washington Post has also covered the same story. The judge in the Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump and his allies said on Friday, 1st of March, he plans to issue a decision within 2 weeks on whether Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis should be disqualified and charges dismissed because of her romance and international travel with lead prosecutor Nathan Wade. Over more than 3 hours of closing arguments on Friday, 1st of March, prosecutors and defense lawyers presented two starkly opposing views on whether Fannie Willis's office should be removed from the case. Defense lawyers argued that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade created a conflict of interest by not disclosing their relationship or travel expenditures. The prosecution argued that the defense never proved their central allegations that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade began dating before she hired him in November of 2021, and that she allowed him to pay for travel that they shared. The salacious accusations have taken the Georgia case far off course since they emerged in a January pleading from one of Donald Trump's co-defendants, delaying proceedings for weeks and now threatening to fully derail the prosecution as the spotlight turns to Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee as he decides what to do. The controversy has attracted a national audience because of its potential impact on the 2024 presidential election, with fresh uncertainty on whether a trial will begin before November and what would happen to the case overall if Donald Trump is elected the President of the United States. It is the second of four ongoing prosecutions against Trump facing delays against the backdrop of the fall election. The federal election interference case in Washington is awaiting an April Supreme Court review of a claim of immunity.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
For 5 months, the Israeli regime has waged what many call a holocaust against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Still, the occupation regime has not been able to achieve any of its stated goals. Palestinian fighters have proved quite resilient and capable of fighting off the enemy. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to discuss the cost of the genocidal war that the Tel Aviv regime has waged against the Palestinians. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this edition. Charlotte Gates, with the International Coordinator of the Summit on Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joins us from Vancouver. Peter Fort, former British ambassador to Syria, is also joining us from Manchester. Now, beginning with Vancouver, Charlotte, there are different aspects to what has cost the Israeli regime in different ways, you know, internal divisions, you know, their standing and maybe popularity or notoriety at the world stage on the diplomatic front. There are many aspects we're going to discuss and explore one by one. So let's begin with this division thing that we see, obviously, among the Israeli officials. We had several Israeli cabinet ministers making objections against the regime's military chief, saying that the Israeli occupation force ground operation in Gaza has not been effective, it's been too slow. And the funny thing is that these are the very same people who opposed to the operation, actually the ground invasion, in the very early days of the war.
Well, one thing that we always see among for Zionist politicians is their willingness to kill Palestinians, occupy Palestinian land, torture Palestinian prisoners. And in fact, these are regularly campaign points in Zionist elections. But what we're also seeing are these fundamental contradictions that are part of this settler colonial project, because this project is having a difficult time maintaining itself. Actually, the 7th of October showed to the Zionist regime and to the world was that it kind of confirmed once and for all that this is going to be a temporary project in the region. No matter how much it throws its billions upon billions of dollars of weaponry upon civilians and massacres civilians, targets schools and hospitals and mosques and churches and residential buildings, it is never going to be able to preserve itself in Palestine and in the region simply by carrying out the mass slaughter of civilians on an industrial scale. And so we're also seeing an inconvenience for the United States and its imperialist backers that are facing increased domestic opposition, a mass protest movement, refusals to vote for Joe Biden and his colleagues so long as they remain complicit in the genocide. And so we're seeing those contradictions also within the U.S. imperialist camp also playing out inside the Zionist regime. It's also very clear that Netanyahu very specifically is extending this war for as long as possible, extending the genocide for as long as possible, refusing to withdraw, refusing to stop bombing, refusing a ceasefire, simply in order to perpetuate his own impunity. Netanyahu has very good reason to be concerned, not only that he's going to be prosecuted for corruption, but that he and his top officials are going to be prosecuted for their utter failure on the 7th of October. And so he's attempting to prolong his own political career, even though the future of the Zionist project itself might be on the line.
Okay. Now, Ambassador Ford, on the diplomatic front, we have Chile and several other South American countries, Honduras, Colombia, Belize, Brazil. They have all recalled their ambassadors. You know, 9 or 10 countries, as I was just searching for this, they have either severed their relations with the Tel Aviv regime or they've at least summoned their envoys. So do you expect this same process to continue?
No, not really. If somebody hasn't cut relations after 5 months of this horror, I don't think they're going to do so now. And in any case, it's not clear that cutting relations is achieving very much. I mean, I'm glad it's happening. It's the right moral thing to do, but if we're honest, we have to say that it's not affecting Israeli behavior. They can absorb this kind of punishment. Israel plays to a gallery of one, Washington, or more precisely, U.S. Congress. They are not worried about anything that anybody else does because they control the U.S. Congress and nothing else matters.
But the least it shows, Ambassador, do you agree that Israel is losing its standing on the international front? Countries are just getting away, you know, keeping distance from the regime.
Well, I think Washington itself is more worried about the loss to its own international standing. America's moral standing in the world is about at floor level after the unlimited support they have given to massacres in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And I think the Americans are sincerely concerned about their loss of reputation and prestige. So far, this hasn't hurt them enough to make them stop arms deliveries to Israel. The Americans will do anything except what is really necessary, that is to cut the arms deliveries. This would force Israel in 24 hours to withdraw, but it's not happening and it's not likely to happen.
All right. Now, speaking of the U.S., Charlotte, there are some analysts arguing that the U.S. administration has become fed up and maybe frustrated with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. So they cite this the trip by Benny Gantz's main political rival of Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's there in Washington, and U.S. officials have accepted to meet him. And what does this trip signal?
Well, the one thing to note about Gantz is that while he is a political rival of Netanyahu, he is also a member of the war cabinet who is currently carrying out this genocide. Mm-hmm. So while he's a political rival of Netanyahu, he's no less of a war criminal and a genocidaire than Netanyahu is. And so it's always really important to keep that at the forefront, because the idea is somehow to portray it to the public in the United States and internationally that Gantz is somehow a kinder, gentler form of Zionist colonizer, but he is at the heart of the war council carrying out the genocide right now. There's certainly been a long history of disputes and disagreements personally and on a tactical level between the U.S. administration and Netanyahu, Netanyahu favoring, for example, in the U.S. elections, Biden's rival, Donald Trump. And so there are some of these kinds of political considerations. But what has always guided this alignment between U.S. imperialism and Zionism is the role that the Zionist regime plays for the United States in the region, you know, as kind of, as they say, a giant aircraft carrier for the United States, placed in the heart of Palestine and carrying out that mission through an ongoing genocide. So the United States is interested in what can continue to keep the Zionist entity alive and keep its own imperial domination of the region alive, especially when the powers and forces of resistance in the region have been growing so significantly, and as we're seeing in Yemen and as we're seeing elsewhere in the region as well. But one of the other things that the U.S. is trying to do, and that U.S. officials are trying to do, is they're trying to signal to the Democratic Party's electoral base in the United States, which is decidedly unenthusiastic and, in fact, outraged by, in many cases, this ongoing supply of weaponry to the Zionist regime and its genocide, and say that, no, we're trying to do something because Biden is expressing mild concern about Netanyahu or meeting with Benny Gantz, who, again, is a co-perpetrator of this genocide. In order to kind of assuage their domestic political base as well as to try to repair their image internationally, but they're failing to do so because the only thing that they need to do is just stop sending them weapons. If they're interested in stopping this, that's all they need to do, and they absolutely refuse to do that.
Right. Now, Peter, let's look at the financial and monetary aspect of this. The cost of waging this deadly war for Tel Aviv regime, I read somewhere, it's rose to almost $60 billion last month. And the government spending is soaring in order to be able to pay for all those bombs and bullets while revenues are dropping. So how badly is the Israeli economy being impacted by this war?
Well, again, we come back to Washington. And it appears that Washington will always bail out the Israeli economy if it gets into real trouble. And it is in real trouble. Its debt has been downgraded by Moody's, the ratings agency. The shekel is bumping along the bottom at 15-year lows. The construction industry has been decimated because they can't use Palestinian workers anymore. Exports are down at an annualized rate of about 40%. They're nearly halved. Investment has almost totally collapsed. So the economy, and they have hundreds of thousands, about 200,000 people who've been displaced in the north and the south. But the Israeli economy seems able to sustain this level of punishment. And as I said at the beginning, at the end of the day, they know they can count on billions coming from the U.S. Congress, which are already on the way.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, that's a question I was just going to ask Charlotte. You know, Israeli tax office announcing that the losses incurred by the Gaza war are six times greater than those of the 33-day war against Lebanon in 2006. And there have been 500,000 requests filed at the Israeli judiciary asking for war reparations and damages. So this can slow down catering for the cost of the Israeli wartime, you know, war machine. Can Tel Aviv stomach all this single-handedly? Like Ambassador Ford said, the U.S. is always there. But what about Israel on its own?
Well, the problem is that Israel is not on its own. It's never been on its own. It's always been part and parcel of the imperialist project in the region. It serves essentially as an arm of the United States. And that is part of the problem. At the same time, it is clear that the resistance is imposing a real cost upon the Zionist project. I mean, and it's making it unsustainable. That's a reality. I mean, there's a reason why on October 7th and the day after, we saw flights to, if they weren't shut down, flights to get out of the Zionist project absolutely packed, because it's a fundamentally unsustainable settler colonial project that can only be maintained through this ongoing massacres, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, up to and including the current ongoing crime of genocide. The Israeli economy essentially is an artificially propped up structure that's constantly being boosted as a so-called startup nation. But in reality, that only exists as a kind of artificially boosted economic force to represent the imperial core in the heart of the Arab nation and the heart of the broader region, none of which has anything to do with this entity that is there. And so this artificial economy is facing severe contradictions, just like we're seeing elsewhere in the world. I mean, look at the effect on the European economy of the U.S.'s promotion of war in Ukraine. The U.S.'s allies are facing significant economic crises as a result of the U.S.'s pursuit of its specific imperial ends. And right now, the U.S. is willing to continue to swallow these costs for the Zionist regime. However, I think it's increasingly clear that the people of the United States are not willing to swallow these costs and are not willing to accept that they are the arms provider for a genocidal settler colonial project in the region.
Yeah, you mentioned people. I'm going to ask Ambassador Ford about Israeli people who are standing against the decisions of their cabinet. The streets of Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities, you know, have turned into battlegrounds between leftists and rightists. And then we also have among the Knesset members, they're trying to gain more share of the power and wealth. Some people want Netanyahu to step down and stand trial, some others don't. So where could these divisions and protests within the Israeli cabinet and also within the ranks of the people end up in?
Well, Netanyahu is certainly under a lot of domestic pressure, but it focuses on the hostages. The great opinion polls show that the great majority of the Israeli public, something like 60-70%, fully support what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza, and another 10-20% think he's not doing enough in terms of killing, maiming, and obliterating Gaza. The Israelis don't see on their televisions or their social media what's going on in Gaza. They don't want to know. They don't want to see. Although he's under some pressure from these street protests, all he has to do is say, well, the only way to get the hostages back is by force of arms. And he can get away with that for a long time to come. He's not feeling enough domestic pressure for it to incline him to end this conflict.
Okay. Charlotte, how do you regard this in terms of this internal division? Could these divisions and also the charges that Netanyahu is facing end up in a new storm against the Israeli cabinet, and to maybe we could see the right is pushed to isolation for quite some time?
Well, I mean, again, there is no left. There is no Zionist left. There is only just different tactics of control and domination of the Palestinian people. But what it is very clear is that the Palestinian resistance, the resistance in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Iran, that there is a regional force that is not accepting the future of Zionist domination of Palestine and the region. And that reality, which is presenting like a future that is actually visualizable, that can actually be seen coming, of a region that is free of the domination of imperialism and of Palestine, that is free of Zionism, despite the tremendous, tremendous war crimes and the horrific human toll that has been exacted by this Zionist genocide in Gaza. That is something that this project is going to face crisis after crisis after crisis until it finally collapses, and until it finally collapses under the weight and power of the resistance and of the Palestinian people and all of the forces that are fighting alongside them in the region. And I think that that's inevitable, and that what we're going to see in the future of the Zionist project is further and further contradictions, deepening contradictions, deepening crises. There's no willingness on the part of the Zionist public to fight. There's a demand to just do more and kill more Palestinians. But at the same time, there's this constant demand for relief, for support, in a way that evidences that this is not a population that is actually willing to live through the kinds of horrors that they are visiting upon the Palestinian people right now, and that they would rather give up the Zionist project in the end, many of them, and retreat to a comfortable location in the West rather than to continue this ongoing, rather than to actually face the future of the falling apart of the Zionist project and then the dismantlement of the Zionist project, which is the only way to achieve justice, liberation, and meaningful peace for all people in Palestine.
Right. Now, Peter, you mentioned the U.S. role, and as you know, the U.N. Security Council draft resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, they have all been vetoed three times, I think, by Washington. So in the last council meeting, all U.N. Security Council members voted for a ceasefire, except the United States, and the UK abstained this time. So does this not show that the U.S. is endangering its own globalist standing and is pushing itself into isolation by giving all this all-out support for the Israeli regime?
It does, but they don't care enough to change their behavior. This is by no means the first time that the US has cast a veto vote on behalf of Israel. There have been scores, if not hundreds, of occasions when that has happened. And they just don't care. I mean, the fact that we keep talking about the UN Security Council shows how much they don't care. It's pure theater, and we delude ourselves believing that the Security Council counts for anything at all in the context of Israel and Palestine because of that U.S. Veto. It's pure theater and delusion. We should not pay any attention to the Security Council, but on the contrary, we should pay more attention to the military situation. Now, it's possible that in the weeks to come, the Israeli military will not be able to pursue their attacks on Gaza simply because of the amount of resistance that they have been meeting and which may increase. I would say that is the front to pay attention to, not right. The theater in New York.
Right. And Charlotte, one last question. You know, according to a February Gallup survey, positive views among the young adults in the U.S. vis-a-vis the Israeli regime dropped to half, from 64% last year to 38% this year. That's almost half. So that means the American people, you know, think differently from the American officials, and they have held big rallies, as you know. So Israeli image has been tarnished among many Americans. At the same time, the government is spending big bucks and taxpayer money in the war against Palestinians instead of addressing issues on the home turf. Your take on that?
I mean, I think that's absolutely true, and we're seeing it. For example, today is a major primary election day in the United States. Even though there is no major Democratic Party within the Democratic Party competitor with Biden on most of the state ballots, we're seeing a number of people voting uncommitted. We saw that in Michigan. That is an attempt to really send a message that the votes that the Democratic Party is relying on in its domestic elections are not going to be there because of the fact that, you know, as we say, genocide Joe Biden is continuing to send weapons, arms, and an unlimited blank check for ongoing genocide to the Zionist regime, as well as casting these repeated vetoes in the United Nations. The demonstrations are continuing across the United States. Just last weekend, on March 2nd, it was kind of an international day of action. And there were 50,000 people marching in New York City. There were tens of thousands in Portland and San Francisco and Los Angeles. There were these massive demonstrations throughout the entire country that have not stopped for 5 months. And